Hello there. Welcome to Just to Be Nominated, a podcast about movies that is distributed by Lee Enterprises. The show is hosted by me, Chris Lay, the podcast operations manager for Lee, along with Bruce Miller, an entertainment reporter for multiple decades who is currently the editor of the Sioux City Journal, and Jared McNett, a reporter for the Globe Gazette in Mason City, Iowa. For every episode, we pick five of our favorite films on a theme or concept, and we go back and forth hashing them out. It is a ton of fun for us as big-time movie nerds, and hopefully we'll turn you on to some flicks that you might not know about or, you know, give you some insight on movies that you already know and love. Last time you heard from us, we were doing the obvious thing and talking about Christmas movies, from certified offbeat classics to horror flicks. Go back to the archives, check that episode out if you have not already. For this episode, we ran down our personal lists of favorite films from 2020, which was far and away one of the most unusual years for movies ever. I don't know about you, dear listener, but I haven't set foot in a theater since early March, and it really breaks my heart. Release dates for some of our most hotly anticipated movies were bumped and rebumped months down the line or on into 2021 outright. Even some of the biggest blockbusters are going to debut on streaming platforms in living rooms nationwide. And maybe you didn't notice, but as I type this, it's been almost 16 months since there's been anything released related to the quote-unquote Marvel Cinematic Universe because, for a great many reasons, New Mutants doesn't count. Regardless of all this, though, there were some amazing movies that the three of us all saw, and in Jared's case, some great TV that he declared to be worthy of inclusion. There were also a ton of films that were great, but didn't end up on our list, and you should let us know about that on Twitter and or in the various podcast review sections that are out there. As always, you can check the show notes for links to where you can stream the movies that we talked about and discover older episodes as well, like the aforementioned Christmas episode. Before we get into our top fives from 2020, though, I wanted to again mention a great new podcast that Lee Enterprises just launched called The Ethical Life, where you can find Richard Kite, director of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University, along with Scott Rada, a journalist and Lee's social media manager, exploring the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'll make sure to get a link for that in the show notes, or you can search for it on your pod player of choice. Now, here it is. Our show kicks off after this short pause, and the first voice you will hear is Bruce.
Whenever they open a movie, they don't let you see it before the Friday that it opens. That's usually a bad sign. That says that this is a stinker, and they're trying to get all the publicity out of it they can, so they have a good first week, but the second week will fall off. But there's been enough good buzz about Wonder Woman that I think they're just trying to save it. It's a lot like when they did Hamilton, and they were real kind of sneaky about that too.
And I mean, there's been a lot of good buzz in general about HBO Max right now.
Yeah, but I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing that they say we're putting all the Warner Brothers films on that next year. I really think they shouldn't have gone all in. They should have just said we're going to put a number of them on HBO Max, and then we'll see how the openings go with theaters. Because I think theaters will open toward the end of the year, and they shouldn't really kind of cut off that arm that I think they are.
And it's definitely weird for them to be in a place, not necessarily HBO Max, but Warner Brothers to be in a place now where like multiple directors that work mostly in their studio system are just like openly like dismissing this move completely. That's usually not the look you want to be presenting outward to people.
Yeah. Yeah. So Bruce touched on it, but for anybody who isn't aware, first of all, we're behind the times. I think the last episode that we recorded, the news of HBO Max being the home of every single major motion picture that Warner Brothers is putting out, I think that hit the trades like 5 minutes after we stopped recording the most recent episode, 2 weeks ago. They announced that they were going to do Blade Runner and all the other movies that were going to be coming out. And some of the directors balked a little bit. I know that Denis Villeneuve said that he was pretty bummed out about it. And there's other issues with money on the back end that people would be getting.
Yeah, I don't know that they really were prepared for the other kinds of questions people would have. It's even right now when you're trying to make a list of the best films of the year, do you count something that was really just a streaming thing as a potential best film? Do you count things like Bad Education on HBO? Is that going to be in contention for best picture? Does Hamilton qualify for anything? You don't know.
Another thing with this too that's kind of interesting to me that a friend of mine was pointing out is that by like moving to put a lot of this stuff, you know, shifting more to like a streaming focus for a lot of this stuff for 2021, I think some of it's going to come out in theaters too, right? But it's mainly focused on streaming. That in some ways you're just then ceding more of that ground for the theaters to Disney, which isn't necessarily the greatest either, because in the past Disney has been pretty controlling about like the number of screens that their movies are shown on and how many times a day they're shown and all that kind of thing. And so that's just giving even more ground to them for when movie theaters do start opening back up, which I think is kind of interesting for Warner Brothers and HBO Max and all those parent companies to be doing.
With the HBO thing, it's the rollout is going to be once every month, more or less, there's going to be a new blockbuster type movie that's going to be coming out. So if you're coming on and you're just investing in 1 month of the subscription, it's going to suck you over and into the next month to where you're going to stay on for, you know, whatever else is coming down the month following. And I think the movies that they're putting out, it's going to be, they'll be released in theaters simultaneously, supposedly, depending on theater availability in your area. And then they will be on HBO Max for 1 month, and then they will disappear and still be in the theaters or available for purchase and DVD and Blu-ray and whatever else, other, you know, down the line. But I think it's only 1 month that each one will be featured on there. So they are pushing people eventually towards theaters to a degree, more so than I think people are giving it credit for, but it still is. I mean, if you've seen Wonder Woman 1984 on Christmas Day on HBO Max, are you going to go back out on, you know, January 5th to a theater and see it? I don't think so.
It's not fair to the theaters, and they've been carrying their freight for all these years, and now they're kind of cutting out the middleman, if you will. That's not right.
Well, that's the position that the theaters have been in for a very long time.
Well, and they've had to rely on concession sales for the most part to make the freight, to be able to pay their employees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't think it's right. But I think they'll regroup, they'll recommit, and we'll see a different. Once we feel that we're safe to go to places, it'll be different.
I still don't know, too, how it's going to work. Well, like functionally, I know how it's going to work, but like with the bigger budget stuff, like obviously now, you know, there's plenty of prestige stuff that's on, you know, Netflix and Hulu and everything. But like, I still, even if you've got a decent like home movie setup, are you really going to watch and enjoy Dune in your own like living room on a TV? Like, I don't think those movies are going to go over the same like on a streaming service.
No. I mean, that's one of the things that I have experienced with this year. For me, part of going to theaters was the absolute necessity of turning off my phone, being in a darkened room.
Yeah.
Knowing that if I get up to go to the bathroom, I'm going to miss something that I cannot rewind. And it makes that experience that much more intense. Whereas, I mean, I'm sure that we will talk in a little bit, you know, further down in the episode about Mank, but that's a movie that I've now watched twice, and I've, you know, focused on it as best I could, but I still have not had at all that same experience, just because there's things around, you know, it's I get a news alert on my phone or whatever. And I mean, these are all things that I could turn off if I wanted to. Sure. But it's just there. Maybe I'm just a bad movie watcher for not being able to turn that off, but I'm not the only one.
Part of it is the shared experience, though. At a comedy, you will laugh if other people are laughing. When you're sitting at home by yourself, that was funny. you know, you're not really, you're not as engaged as you would be in a group setting.
Jared and I have both talked about, I think the last movies that we saw in the theater were both The Invisible Man.
I saw Tenet at a drive-in, but not my favorite experience of the year.
I saw that at a theater, and I thought it really needed the theater experience. I thought it was good to see on a big screen, not necessarily on my home.
Yeah.
That's one that I still haven't seen, and I feel like I have not done my duty to see it, but I wasn't going to go to a theater, so I haven't seen it. It just hit streaming, but it's $20 to own it, and based on everything that I've... Like, you can't just rent it. You have to buy it outright for $20 on every single service.
I think it really would have gotten a big shot toward the end of the year, and now, at best, if it's going to make a top 10 list, it's going to be at the bottom.
Yeah.
It's not going to be the number one movie at all.
The action in it, not surprisingly, is really good, but the... Like, even compared to, like, Inception, the plot is just incomprehensible at points. And, like, I was literally at a point when I was watching it in the drive-in, I had the Wikipedia article up just so I could be following along with the plot. And that still was not helpful enough. So that's never a good sign when you need that kind of assist and it still is not working and connecting.
And that movie... it feels like is very tied and will forever be tied to the industry aspect of the pandemic.
Yep.
That movie came out and it fell flat because Nolan insisted that it go out, which I understand, but this is not the time. And for that to be the canary in the coal mine, you know, it showed that the things weren't ready for it. And they did not recoup their investments on it at all. And so it's always going to be a movie that I think the perception of it, if it's going to improve, it's going to take a lot longer. And on my list of movies, I can think of, I mean, there's at least two that jump out right now that are tied directly to the emotions that have been swirling around in my head and heart over the past, you know, 9-10 months, and those really colored the experience of those particular films.
Well, do you want to get started then, Chris?
Come on.
All right. The first movie that I've got is Host. I mean, I don't even know if it really qualifies. I think it's only like 50 some minutes long, and it is it's filmed entirely as a Zoom call, and it was the first, I think, pandemic content to actually reflect on the pandemic. So it's a group of friends who have a seance that gets out of control. And the way that it's done is very ingenious. And of the films that have tried to use laptop cameras and found footage type structures of that, I think it's certainly the most inventive and the one that holds together the best and also just really nailed where everyone was at that time. And if we wanted to put together a time capsule to remember this moment by, if we wanted to, just to kind of capture the PTSD of it for years down the line, I think Host should absolutely go in that time capsule.
Yeah. And if anybody doesn't know, like, they directed all of that remotely, if I remember right. Like, they had to get the actors in their own locations to set up their own cameras and lighting and do their own stunts. And the actors, I think, even handled their own, like, practical effects and virtual effects stuff too. So, like, it was really like a at a distance process.
The aesthetic of it was perfect for what it feels like to actually be on a Zoom call now with friends and in a social situation, not a work situation necessarily.
Well, that sounds like a good one. I did not see it.
That's a good first pick. That was one I wasn't actually necessarily expecting at all.
So let's have one, Jared.
So my first one came out back in July, right around my birthday, actually. And I'm a sucker for movies with Groundhog Day type premises. And so my first pick is Palm Springs with Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti, and then also J.K. Simmons in a very J.K. Simmons-y type role as a sort of heavy in the movie. And yeah, it's very much like a Groundhog Day type thing where Andy Samberg is basically caught in these perpetual time loops. And at the beginning of it, much like, you know, Bill Murray in Groundhog Day, or even the main character in like Happy Death Day, Andy Samberg is very much a ne'er-do-well at the beginning. He's kind of aimless, doesn't really have his life together at all. And then gradually throughout the movie, that sort of changes. I think it's a really well-done rom-com. I think Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti have really great chemistry. There's some great supporting performances in there. I mentioned J.K. Simmons, but also Connor O'Malley. If anyone is familiar with him and his brand of comedy, he's in there and is fantastic. June Squibb from like Nebraska fame pops up as the grandma. She's great. It's just a very low stakes movie, but it's done really well. And I always have time for low stakes movies that are done right, especially when they're comedies, because we don't have enough good comedies anymore.
I will agree that it's low stakes, but the execution of it really took a lot of time to work out, and it rewards multiple viewings. It's low stakes, but it has a tremendous amount of depth to it. It's there if you want to really wade into it. And just like Groundhog Day, I think it has a lot of the same existential subtext to it that you can, you know, really, you know, let seep in with increased viewings.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is they're not pushing that one as they should, as much as they should, for Oscar attention.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Yeah, oddly, King of Staten Island is getting a bigger push. You see more about that. And I'm thinking, well, that was interesting, but it wasn't as creative as Palm Springs was. So
there really just is nowhere for comedies to be recognized when it comes to award season. Like, kind of the Golden Globes, but nobody really takes those seriously. So
part of it also comes down to the fact that it was it got bought for a ton of money at one of the festivals.
Sundance, wasn't it?
Yeah, it got set a record at Sundance. And you know, for getting bought, and then because of quarantine and lockdown, Hulu picked it up, and Hulu, I feel like, just does not do a good job. They buy these things up sometimes in the case of Palm Springs, and then they just don't know how to push them out there in the same way that these other platforms do. And I mean, with, I don't know if it's just the user interface of Hulu that is a problem, but to find stuff that you actually want to watch in Hulu is just a complete pain in the ass.
Well, are you ready for my first pick?
Absolutely, please.
I hope you haven't seen it, and I hope that you do plan to see it. Nomadland. Have you seen Nomadland?
No, but I've been keeping tabs on that one.
Frances McDormand is incredible. She plays this woman who really doesn't, her husband dies, and she's going to be one of these people who go around in RVs all around the country. They pick up, you know, odd jobs when they want to or when they can, and then they just keep moving on. They never really light anywhere because they don't like that. And you see her, she's in Nebraska, she's at the Wall Drug in South Dakota, she's everywhere just doing these kind of jobs and the kind of lifestyle it is. Incredible. It's a very good kind of character study. And she is just marvelous in this thing. David Strathairn is in it as a guy that she meets at one of the places. And they kind of have a relationship. And she goes and visits him. But I don't want to tell you what happens with them. But yeah, it's, and they used real people who are actually nomads in the film. So when you look at the credits, one of the people had died. And they dedicated the film to her. And then there are also other ones. And they say they are actual nomads. So it's an interesting slice of life. And I think now during these times, you think maybe that's what I need to do, is just travel around and not worry about anything and just enjoy what I can see and find out and learn. But I don't know that I could live alone like that for that long.
Yeah. And that's directed by Chloe Zhao, who is working on Marvel's The Eternals.
Yeah, right. So that's my first pick, and I hope you get to see it. It's starting to open in areas. It's kind of doing a wave now. I think around the 4th, it started hitting theaters. And I'm assuming that you'll see it before the end of the year somewhere else in a streaming service.
Yeah, I think you can maybe rent it, but I'm not sure.
So, Bruce, is Frances McDormand going to get another Oscar nomination then?
Definitely nominated. I don't think she's going to win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we're edging toward that thing where they get to three and they get real nervous about, yeah, we'll give you the nomination, but we're not giving you the three. Look how long it took Meryl Streep to get her third, a long time. But I do have somebody else on the list that I think will be the winner.
Yeah, this has been a weird year for awards. I mean, with distribution stuff getting so thrown out of whack. I mean, Nomadland, it's another one where people generally haven't been able to see it. It picked up a lot of buzz in the, you know, what festival circuits there were.
Frances was one of the producers of it too, so you can see she was really. I think they met at one of those like Independent Spirit Awards, and they said we should work together, and they actually found this, and this was what they decided to do. Okay, what's next?
So that would be me again, and this is kind of one from the sort of the early days of the pandemic when there wasn't as much to watch because all the theaters were closing. Streaming options were a little more spotty, at least in terms of new stuff. And so a couple weeks ago when we talked about food stuff, one of my picks was Euro Dreams of Sushi. And one of my reasons for that is because it's always a joy to watch someone who's the best at what they do work. And so my next pick is The Last Dance, which is a sports documentary about Michael Jordan and his final season with the Chicago Bulls. It kind of is following, obviously not as much controversy, but it's kind of following in the same vein that ESPN did with the OJ documentary that it did. It's supposed to be taken as one movie, even though it's broken up into 10 parts. And like the OJ documentary, I was really impressed at the way they were able to wring a lot out of something that everyone probably thinks at this point that they know everything there is to know because Michael Jordan is such a famous person. But there were a lot of great revelations in that documentary, especially the episode that focused a lot on Dennis Rodman and how he kind of fit in with the team. I'm a big basketball fan, and I absolutely loved it, and that's definitely coloring some of my love for it. But I think even if you're not the biggest basketball fan, you can kind of find joy in just the way it looks at like some of the pop culture stuff from that time. And again, there is just a small joy in watching someone who's one of the best ever at what they did working in their apex. So The Last Dance is my second pick.
There have only been a handful of things that I have really anticipated coming out. And that's one where every single week when there was a new episode that was, you know, landing on the ESPN channel was like, gotta watch it first thing in the morning. And so many great revelations, very memeable as well.
Oh yeah. Yep.
I mean, thankfully the crying Michael Jordan meme will hopefully be replaced by the Michael Jordan reacting to an iPad.
Yes. I took that personally. Yep.
It was the Tiger King of its part of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Although I would say probably a little better made maybe than Tiger King.
Maybe just a tish better.
A little bit.
It might have gotten us to raise our standards. After we saw Tiger King, we said, oh, come on, we can't be watching crap like this all the time. We got to have a little better. And they go, well, how about Last Dance? Go for that.
So I was just going to jump in with my next pick, which is a movie that I only watched recently, and it's on Amazon Prime, and it's called I'm Your Woman, directed by Julia Hart. It stars Rachel Brosnahan, who is Marvelous Miss Maisel, as the wife of a mobster guy. And the mobster guy turns on his crew, and then she has to be evacuated and protected because everyone's trying to get her and the baby that she's with. And it's just truly fantastic. Just a great period piece from the 70s. And one of the things that I've picked up during the quarantine was I've been reading a ton of old pulpy crime fiction. And one of the things you get in there is the, you know, the enforcer, the hitman, the whatever, you know, who gets on the wrong side of the people that he's working for. And this is just the other side of that. The way that affects the other people and the emotions and experiences that it draws out are really fascinating. And it, yeah, it's just really, really well done. And I feel like it's going to be pretty underseen, but is well worth people tracking down. And it's like I was saying earlier with being distracted by phone or bathroom, whatever, this one within the first like 10 or 15 minutes, it just absolutely sucked me in the same way that a really good, you know, pulpy crime novel just kind of turns into a page turner, before you know it, and you can't put it down and you're done with it in, you know, 2 days. So I'm Your Woman, on Amazon Prime. Excellent stuff.
How was Rachel Brosnahan? Is she good?
Yes. Very, very good. I think it's interesting because this, it treats her almost like a character actress. I mean, it doesn't lean into the fact that everyone knows her from Mrs. Maisel. Not that it ever should.
She looks different in this too, doesn't she?
Yes. Yeah. And there are some really wonderful twists and turns all along the way. It really keeps you guessing. And it's the exact film that I wanted to watch given this year and given the interest that I've been, really digging down on. So good stuff.
Okay. My next one is going to be a documentary, and I should be saying Dick Johnson Is Dead is the one I'd pick, but I'm not. I like Dick Johnson Is Dead. I thought it was very clever, very creative. And the filmmaker, basically, if you don't know, kills her father off several times during the course of a film because she wants to try and deal with the actual loss that will happen at some point because he has Alzheimer's and he's losing touch with her. And dad's in for all of this. They have like an air conditioner falling on them and all these kind of fun things that are very cute. But that's not my pick. My pick is Boys State. I really, really loved Boys State. I thought it showed young people in a light that maybe reflects what we're seeing in politics today. And I enjoyed the way they played with everything, the way they showed the people. They were everywhere you needed to be to understand what Boys State is all about. And it introduced us to people who gave me hope that in the next year or so, we're not going to have to listen to politicians who just lie to us. We're going to listen to people who actually want to do something for us. So, Boys State.
They had Boys State, Missouri, and I never got involved with it, but I feel like I have similar experiences just in a different realm, kind of with some of the tone that I saw from that movie, which is spending years and years doing an academic team throughout high school and college and grad school. And that's another subject. I thought it was a perfect subject when I saw that they were making a movie about Boys State. Competitive academic team is another one that eventually needs to have a documentary made about it at some point, because I think it would be just as absorbing as you found Boys State, Bruce, for some of the similar reasons, but also some very different ones as well, because there'd be some more King of Kong type vibes to it.
What's the Rubik's Cube one that was out this year too?
Speed Cubers or something?
Yeah, that's cute too, and that kind of covers that same world where they're very insular, and then you kind of have to rise above to become the king of the hill or whatever. But I enjoy that too. But it's the same thing. Spelling Bee is another one that would be a very easy mark for these kinds of films. But I liked Boys State. I thought it said a lot about our times.
And where is that available? I think that's streaming somewhere, isn't it?
I think it's Apple TV Plus. Jared, what's next?
So my next one, I think, kind of goes to what you were saying a little bit, Bruce, about, like, you know, and this has been a discussion for a number of years now, I feel like, of just what even, you know, constitutes a movie now versus a show or a miniseries. I think this qualifies as a film, even though it would be a long one qualifying as a film. But my next pick is The Queen's Gambit. It's based on a singular text. It's based on a 1983 book by Walter Tevis of the same name, which I feel like is informed a little bit by his own life. He wrote a couple of books early on, including Man Who Fell to Earth, and I think, was it The Hustler? The Hustler, early on. And then he kind of just, like, didn't do anything for a while and kind of was just a alcoholic kind of roaming around. And so there's a little bit of that informing the show, too, and the book. And it's just a really great showcase for Anya Taylor-Joy, who people might remember from The Witch. That's where I first saw her and loved her performance in that. And that's still one of my favorite horror movies of the past decade. She's also in Thoroughbreds, which is a fun revenge-y kind of movie from a couple years back. But it's just really well done. For anyone that doesn't know, it's all about chess in the 50s and 60s. And it does a good job of capturing that particular time. And you kind of get to see Anya Taylor-Joy's chess prodigy character kind of moving through those times, which I always a sucker for a well-done film or piece of art of someone kind of moving through the decades, a little bit like Mad Men in that way. And then, again, the supporting cast in this is really solid. Bill Camp, who's in, like, every single HBO thing ever, is in it and is very good as a custodian that kind of informs Anya Taylor-Joy's character along the path to becoming a chess prodigy. And I mentioned Academic Team a second ago, and I think one reason I loved it so much is because so much of, like, The Queen's Gambit, again, reminded me of my times in that, including just, like, being in car rides with people that are even more obsessive about this kind of stuff than you are, wanting to, like, replay old matches in their head and all that sort of thing. So I definitely had some nostalgia watching it, too, even though I was never any kind of a chess prodigy.
I am going to take you to task, Jared. I would not have considered that as a film. I mean, I'm not going to, like, strike it from the list or anything.
It is on Letterboxd. I will say that, too.
It totally is. And I think there is something to be said for it as a cinematic experience, but it's not something that I think anyone could be expected to sit through in a theater. But, I mean, again, I think it kind of captures the place where we're at now with movies and streaming things becoming
blurred,
intertwined. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Especially because it came out on Netflix, which I know Netflix has it exerts a pretty strong hand sometimes for its products in the way that they end episodes to have a hook that'll catch you on to the next one, the way that they, drill down into all of their analytics to make things that much more addictive, which is not to say that The Queen's Gambit is not incredibly high quality. It was certainly one of the most enjoyable things that I consumed this year for sure. But yeah, it's tough. Because it's, where do you put it? And I feel like it's where, seeing that graying of the middle ground.
The first episode I thought was slow. And I don't know if I sat and watched it in a theater, I would go, oh, I got to sit here for a couple more hours and see what happens. I might bail. It seemed very masterpiece theater to me, where you kind of, it's Sunday night, I got nothing else to do. I'll soak it in for a while. But I get where it was very much binging. It was a binge fest for people, and I know they loved it.
There's the same kind of thing, too, about like Twin Peaks, The Return, and whether or not that constituted a show or not. And I think even a couple different like publications had it as like their number one film of like the year that Twin Peaks The Return came out. So yeah, there's just going to be even more and more of that kind of blurring.
There's a snobbishness too that accompanies that kind of stuff. It's like, well, I didn't think there was anything good enough that was on the screens, so I'm going to pick something on the television as my choice. And it is what it is. It's all entertainment. I support your choice. I don't have it on my list, so I can't say that I would second the motion.
Comes to me next.
Now Chris is going to pick Hamilton.
I am not. I'm not going to pick Hamilton. I am going to go the opposite direction. I'm going to pick a movie by Amy Simetz called She Dies Tomorrow, which people can find on Hulu. And that's another one that it falls into the same category of Host for me, where it's married very much to the experience of the pandemic. She Dies Tomorrow. The plot is kind of vague in one of the characters who has, some mental illness issues that she's dealing with. She becomes convinced that she's going to die tomorrow.
And then in the process of her telling other people that, it ends up becoming contagious, that idea of dying tomorrow. And so kind of buried in its core is this, you know, existential, you know, quandary of how would you live your life if you had that? I mean, it's heavy, but it's not as dour, I think, as maybe I'm making it out. And part of that is due to the lead actress, who I've seen a bunch of other stuff. Her name is Kate Lynn Schell, who is, she's kind of mumblecore adjacent, if that isn't the most pretentious way to describe anyone ever. I discovered her in the documentary called Kate Plays Christine from a few years back.
Yep. Excellent documentary.
Which is, it's Kate Lynn Schell as herself researching a role to play Christine Chubbuck, a real life Florida newscaster who committed suicide live on air in the mid-70s. And so it's her interrogating the acting process of doing that and, you know, taking on somebody else. And anyway, that's neither here nor there, because that's a movie that came out 4 years ago. But She Dies Tomorrow, the lead actress definitely employs a lot of the same, you know, vulnerabilities and maybe not unhinged, but certainly disconnected from reality. But it becomes more real as it, I guess, quote unquote, infects other people. So there is this imminent, you know, sense of mortality floating through it, as well as the idea of contagion. And yeah, it's pretty short. It's like not even 90 minutes.
My kind of film if they're short.
Yes. But yeah, it's very good. A little bit impressionistic, I suppose. It's more about, I think, you know, conveying emotions and creating atmosphere than telling any kind of a coherent plot. Not that you can't follow it, but it's dense. It's got a lot there. I feel like it's a it's not a tough sit, I suppose. But yeah. Anyway, it's on Hulu. Everybody can see it, and I think they should.
Okay. All right. I'm picking The Trial of the Chicago Seven as my next one.
Ooh.
I liked it. It was it's always talky with Aaron Sorkin, and you know, static in places, yes, but I think it popped with life, especially when we see things that are very similar to what's going on now and how people are trying to control the outcome. You look at protesters in a much different way after you see this. And I think that was his intention, too. And full of Best Supporting Actor nominees. It's going to be a feast just from this film alone. Who will get nominated? Sacha Baron Cohen, Mark Rylance, Eddie Redmayne, Frank Langella. There's a lot there that you could pick from. And I thought it was, and definitely Aaron Sorkin will be nominated for Best Screenplay. I know that's going to happen.
That was what I was just going to say, was I think the acting nominations, I wouldn't be shocked if some of these come through for folks, but the only one that I know for sure is going to end up on the ballot would be the screenplay. I mean, it is just fantastic.
It, you know, it depends on how Netflix decides to pick which films they're going to push. I think because they have 10 nominees, it'll get a nomination for Best Picture. We've already sent out the script in it's like a coffee table book. It's huge. And it's got all of the photos and things from the film, and then the script itself. And I know they are pushing that very heavily for Best Screenplay. So I think it does have a real shot at winning that.
That's one of those ones that I still have yet to see. And there's two main reasons for it. One of them is I've never been the biggest Aaron Sorkin fan. Like, I hate The West Wing. I think it's awful dreck. I've only ever seen the one clip from The Newsroom from like the first episode and hated that. I liked the screenplay for like The Social Network. That was pretty good, but that was helped too by David Fincher. So that's part of it. And then the other part of it is it's one of those things that I'm nervous about watching because I actually know and like care a lot about that particular time period, especially like 1968, which is what kicks everything off in the movie. I took like an entire class about that and have read like books on books on books about 1968. And I just know watching it from like the way Aaron Sorkin has rendered like political conversations and stuff from like West Wing and some of his other shows, that he's going to pull different stuff from that year and what it meant than what I probably would. And that's going to be just an impasse that would be too hard for me to overcome while watching it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's been a lot of talk recently about Netflix's The Crown and whether or not that needs a stamp that says this is a work of fiction or this has been dramatized. And I think the conversation about how much of the trial of the Chicago Seven is historically accurate is also up in the air, but I think people haven't really hit on that as much, or it didn't make as big of a splash, probably just because more people are watching The Crown in general. But I mean, it seems like it'd be pretty easy because you're talking about court transcripts, but my understanding is that Aaron Sorkin definitely was a little bit fast and loose with some of it. So yeah, I understand your concerns for sure, Jared. And I also, I disagree wholeheartedly with your Aaron Sorkin issues other than The Newsroom. I think The Newsroom deserves all the flack that it gets, but I respect your right to have bad opinions. So there you go.
You know, Aaron Sorkin spent a lot of time with Tom Hayden. And I think that there's the Tom Hayden bias in this, where I remember him as a different person from that time, you know, and I think he comes off as more of a hero than I remember him to be now. And I'm sure that's because he had access to him,
right?
But he wasn't talking to all the other people that were in this story. There are really a lot. And that is Aaron Sorkin's kind of way. He takes a side and then tries to prove the side as he's mounting his film. And I guess that's where people don't realize it. There's no movie that's truth. Even documentaries aren't truth. It's there's a bias in there somehow. And you have to be willing to go with that. And then, okay, maybe do some own your research on your own to figure out what the true story actually was.
Yeah. Everything is constructed and manicured in some way, unless it's just raw feed. And even then it's, you know, it's not entirely objective.
So Trial of the Chicago Seven was my number three pick.
I think, Jared, it comes back to you.
Tiger King, come on, do it.
Well, this is another one that's a little outside the box, but it's not a show, so we're not going to haggle about that. It's almost more of a short than anything, but I don't think anything else in the entire year as perfectly embodies the year and will be a better time capsule for the year and everything that happened from the pandemic to all of the protests over the summer than the stand-up special that Dave Chappelle did, 8:46, which I think absolutely counts as a film, as you know, stand-up specials often do, even though it's only 27 minutes. I think it's one of the better stand-up specials that he's put out. I think he's as sharp as ever when it comes to talking about politics, especially talking about politics that were like still happening and unfolding as he was talking about them. And of course, he's doing that at an event that, you know, is socially distanced and is outside and has people wearing masks and everything. So it's just this like nexus point of just so many different things that happened this year in one, again, it's 27 minutes and it fits basically everything that happened this year into those 27 minutes and does it while being funny and being poignant.
Yeah. And 8:46, the title of it is the amount of time that was it Eric Garner? No,
the 8:46 of the title is in reference to the 8 minutes and 46 seconds that Derek Chauvin, the police officer in Minneapolis, knelt on the neck of George Floyd. And then it's also, as Dave Chappelle talks about in the stand-up special, the thing that hit him about that being the time is that is also the time on his birth certificate. It was 8:46 a.m. And so that's a weird connection that he kind of explores there too.
Well, you did go rogue again. That was another one that doesn't count necessarily on my list, but I always love Dave Chappelle, so I'm okay with it. But technically, you've got to do some more movie watching, my dear. It's a little pleasure on the TV stuff.
I really would be intrigued to go back and, you know, compare
what it was last year. I feel like I hit all of the movies last year that I wanted to see. And this year there's still a whole bunch that I didn't see. Even ones that were generally widely available. I'm thinking, obviously, like I said earlier, I still haven't seen Tenet, which is, you know, I need to before I close the book on 2020, for better or worse. Yeah, the amount of things, part of the blurring that we've discussed earlier, the reason why I think it's reasonable to put The Queen's Gambit and the Dave Chappelle special on there is that we've watched everything on our TVs for the most part. And so there isn't that hard line delineating what's a theater experience and what's a home experience. And so everything kind of feels like it's the same in a way, or that it can be judged the same in a way.
Okay, Chris.
My pick is one that I feel a certain amount of anxiety about revisiting, because I think the first viewing of it was appropriately confusing. And that is Charlie Kaufman's I'm Thinking of Ending Things, which is a movie, if you go back and listen to the pre-pandemic episode that we did about movies that we were looking forward to, I think I'm Thinking of Ending Things is one of the only ones that made the list that I was looking forward to and actually came out. I'm Thinking of Ending Things is Charlie Kaufman. It's his script and his direction. And it's based on a book by Ayn Reid. It is difficult to sum up plot-wise, and I don't even really know where to begin. The whole thing feels like a dream, but is put together in a very specific way. But I don't feel like disassembling it will give it much. Like, it's not like you're going to come out of the other side having a better understanding of what it is. And it feels like a mystery, but it isn't. It's just a very strange sit in the same way that all things Charlie Kaufman kind of are. And I feel like this is the one that he's done that is the most cut loose from formal structures and presentations. And I mean, that's saying something when you look at Anomalisa and Synecdoche, New York as his two other films that he's directed.
This is another one that just kind of speaks to what my habits were this year. I generally like Charlie Kaufman other than Anomalisa. There are so many people in that cast that I absolutely love, especially the main four people. And I still haven't actually sat down and watched this. I've just been like watching other things or reading other things or doing other things. And I'm almost certain from everything I've read on it and knowing who's in it and knowing, you know, Charlie Kaufman's work, that I'm going to like it. I still just, for whatever reason, the way this year has been, I have not gotten to that and sat down and watched it.
Yeah. Whenever you describe it, and I'm sure that you know, kind of picked up on this in hearing other people talk about it, just the general perception, it's difficult to talk about without making it sound like it's homework.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like it's going to stretch your brain. Like, you've got to be taking notes, and that's not the case. It's not an easy sit necessarily, but it's really funny. And it's difficult to talk about without making it sound like it's work. But in reality, it's.
How is Jessie Buckley? Is she good?
Very good. Yes. Very, very good.
She had a big year, and then she did Fargo too. And she is so wildly divergent in the things that she does. It's really fun to see her stretch. And she'll be a name you'll see more often.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned her when we talked about this movie before. I'm thinking of ending things. A couple years ago, if no one's seen it, she was in a movie called Beast, which is like a British like psychological thriller that was one of my favorite movies from that entire year. She's a really good actress, and I hope to see her in as much things as possible.
Yeah, she's one of those chameleons that you'll see. She's probably this generation's Meryl Streep, where you're going to see her years from now, where you go, oh my God, yeah, she's one of the big ones.
I mean, honestly, I think this year, the breakouts that we've talked about so far, Anya Taylor-Joy, Jesse Buckley, I think
Caitlin Shell, who I mentioned earlier. I mean, there are Rachel Brosnahan doing movies. There are, you know, some really fantastic actress roles that are out there. I can't think of too many things that are so, you know, heavily reliant on men in the same way that women, you know, really carried a lot of these movies. So, I mean, and you mentioned Frances McDormand, who obviously is a legend.
All right. You ready for one more that's like that?
Hit me.
Viola Davis in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Oh my God. Is this the performance of a lifetime? That's how good she is. It is unbelievable.
That's saying something for her too, as an actress.
Mm-hmm. You know, and she's not been silent about not getting good parts. Well, this was a part that, man, she just knocks it out of the park. That's how good it is. She plays a 1920s singer, Ma Rainey, who is going to record her famous song, Black Bottom. But, you know, she in the 20s, you know what the situation was for Black people. It was not, they were in control. But in this situation where she's in the recording studio, she is in control. And she lets everybody know that it's her way or no way. And Viola just handles every bit of that. She has a nephew who has a stuttering problem, but she wants to have him do the introduction. You've seen the rest, now hear the best. Here's Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And the boy can't get through it. He's just stumbling. And the trumpet player says, come on, let's just do it. Let's get somebody else. No, we're doing it my way, or it's not going to be done anyway. And she just really captures that whole, you can feel every sense that she has in this. And when they try to stall, she says, where's my Coca-Cola? I said I wanted a Coca-Cola. You didn't bring me a Coca-Cola. I'm not singing until I get my Coca-Cola. And they come, they run with to get the bottles of Coke, and they come with these three bottles, and she just glugs one down all on camera. And you think, oh my God, he's drinking the whole Coke at once. All right, when I'm ready, we're going to start. And so it's very, very, very fun to see how she can control the situation. But her biggest challenge is Chadwick Boseman in his last performance as this trumpet player who wants her to come into a newer age. He thinks that the song is too slow. He wants to do a different arrangement. And those two square off like you can't believe. And he's incredible. It's sad that it's his last performance, but the idea that he can play toe-to-toe with her on this is so, so rewarding. It's just so great to see. But it's coming out this next week. You'll be able to see it on your Netflix. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is one you should not miss.
We are recording this on Friday the 18th, which I believe is the day that it comes out on Netflix. So
you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Bruce, two things for you about it, because I still haven't seen it, but you mentioned like them kind of going toe to toe. Obviously, they're very different movies, but in some ways, does it have the same kind of feel that like There Will Be Blood did with like Paul Dano actually being able to keep up with what Daniel Day-Lewis was doing?
Yeah, it's, you know, what I thought was very kind of fun about this is that Chadwick Boseman has always kind of played these very upstanding, honorable people who are, you know, where he's kind of already the hero before you get in there. And he's really not in this. He's not the one you side with right away. You think, oh, come on, shut up. She's in charge. Let her have it. And how he plays it. I kept thinking, oh, I could just see him playing James Baldwin in a movie about James Baldwin, if only he were around to do that. I mean, it's, you know, they're talking now that, yeah, he probably could win Best Actor. I hope they give it to him, because this should be remembered. That's how good the part is and how he is in it. It's just, and when it was on Broadway, it was a supporting role. It was not a lead actor role, but they've made it that way. And he does some kind of heinous things that you think, oh, wait a minute here now. I'm with Ma on this one.
I was curious too, Bruce, is most of it, it sounded like from the way you're describing it, is most of it playing out over the course of just like a day or two?
Very confined. It's basically in the recording studio. They'll go outside a little bit. Like the kid has to run and get the Cokes. And they show her coming through a hotel. And, you know, she kind of has that stern look on her. And you think, don't mess with Ma. And it's great. It's great. And if you remember, August Wilson has done this cycle. It's called the century cycle of plays, where he did every decade as a different play. Fences was the last one that we saw her in, and she won the Oscar for that. And then this is the 20s version. That was the 50s version. And Denzel Washington is producing all of these. So you can imagine they're going to be very, very good.
I was going to say, yeah, the pedigree for this film just precedes it by leaps and bounds. And it sounds like the film itself lives up to the hype.
It's great. It's great.
Doing it that way, like, I'm obviously, I've talked about it before, I'm a huge music guy. That's where I come from. I wrote about music for years and everything. I always hate any music movie that decides to just try to do the whole life of a musician, when I think they're way better off doing like what this movie does, where I can't think of another example now. There are other ones that I like where it's just a singular moment in that musician's life, because I think you can ultimately glean a lot more about who they are and what they represented and their particular kind of art by just these slices of moments, instead of trying to tell their entire life story in a 2-hour movie. So I always am interested in these sorts of movies about musicians where it's one moment in their career where they're, you know, trying to nail that song, or where they're just playing absolutely crap bars somewhere. Those are always way more interesting. So I'm definitely going to see this one.
You'll like it. You'll love it. It's like when they did, you know, they'll do like, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. There was a movie where it was just one case early in her career. Thurgood Marshall was another one that they did those things with. And I think this worked perfectly for this. I had no clue who Ma Rainey was, but it made me want to find out more about her and how she really, you see pictures at the end too, and they page through the career and things like that. But it's a great role, and it's played to hilt by Viola Davis. She's wonderful.
Fantastic. So I think it's you, Jared.
It is. And unless I'm forgetting one, this is the last movie I saw in a regular theater before the pandemic hit. Well, I guess a drive-in's a regular theater. I shouldn't be dismissive of drive-ins and Tenet, but seeing in a Cineplex back in February, it's still
Trolls World Tour. I bet it was.
No, it's actually Doolittle with Robert Downey Jr.
Good. Sorry.
But no, I'm a big horror movie guy, which has come up plenty, and I think this should already go in the horror movie canon for how effective the scares are and everything. And that's The Invisible Man, which is starring Elizabeth Moss in the lead role, who's basically tormented and controlled and trapped in a violent relationship with this guy who has this tech that eventually makes him invisible and allows him to stalk her. And that's where a lot of the tension in the movie comes from. Lee Whannell wrote and directed it. He is also responsible for the Saw franchise, at least the first one. He worked on the first Insidious, so he has some major horror chops. And then since then, he started directing stuff. 2 years ago, he did Upgrade, which is a great like sci-fi horror action homage to like RoboCop and those sorts of dystopian movies. He really knows how to do tense scenes, and there's a lot of them in The Invisible Man. And I can't really think of another horror movie where there's the same level of panic as there is in this, when it's just a wide shot and no one else is there. Even though you know someone obviously is there, but it's one of the scarier movies I've seen in a while, and I love it for that. And it's the most fun I had watching a movie this year.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. The way that he used the wide shots, you know, and captured all the depth of field as a means of, you know, really ramping things up. Where, I mean, you really are staring in every single corner of the frame, you know, just trying to catch a small little flicker of something that would signify, you know, what's coming. And yeah, it was tremendous. And yeah, all the subtext, that's in there about toxic masculinity and excellent pick.
Did you two see Her and Shirley?
No, I still need to see that one also, but that's another kind of horror related thing with her in it.
Yeah, it has one of those kind of like, what is up with her? And you're never really sure, but I think she is better in Shirley than she is in Invisible Man. And she could be nominated for Best Actress for that, because it's that kind of a performance. And that's the dear Elizabeth Moss. So I'm sorry.
That's a hell of a year for her, which, I mean, obviously for the longest time, she's gotten plenty of plaudits for TV. But I feel like now, finally, she's being taken way more seriously in film roles, too.
Shirley is one that is on my list, and I just have not gotten to. I know that it's ended up on a lot of short lists for folks, so it's entirely possible that'll end up on my list eventually. I've really enjoyed the work of the director of Shirley, Josephine Decker. Madeline's Madeline, I thought, was fantastic.
Okay, Chris.
My last one, David Fincher's Mank.
Okay, let's discuss. Why did you like Mank?
I liked Mank because I am a huge admirer of Citizen Kane. I mean, like, going into it, I rewatched Citizen Kane with the, you know, the Roger Ebert commentary on. There's also, you know, some other, you know, commentaries on there. And yeah, I'm fascinated by it. And Mank felt like the kind of film that you can rewatch and find all of these new ways to appreciate it every single time. The second time that I watched it already, I feel like the dialogue was that much snappier. And yeah, the first time that I saw it, it didn't do a tremendous amount for me. And the sound design of it, where it's designed to sound like you're watching it in an old theater, and the, like, the cigarette burns that are in the corner of the frame to signify that a reel should be changed to the projectionist, even though obviously this movie has not, and likely, you know, might not actually ever screen in a theater, is, you know, that all felt like a, you know, like a little too much artifice. And then the second time I watched it, it just, I don't know, it hit in a tremendous way. Gary Oldman does an incredible job as Herman Mankiewicz, who, you know, for anyone who is unaware, the film Mank, it's about Herman Mankiewicz, who is credited as the co-screenwriter of Citizen Kane. And so it's not necessarily about Citizen Kane. It's about Hollywood around that era. I
thought it had more to do with the influences that went into making Citizen Kane.
Yes.
You saw where he got the inspiration for certain things. And he really wasn't all that anti-William Randolph Hearst. He was just kind of commenting on things. And he was friends with Marion Davies, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like, oh, she's going to come off as this real idiot in this show. But, you know, I had a moment. I loved the photography. I thought it looked really, really lush. I even went up close to the screen. You can't do that at a theater. And looked at everything, and it was also crisp. But there was a time when it got to be a little talky, and I wanted to just kind of, okay, I got to rest it a little bit.
No, I can totally understand that. I mean, it definitely, there's a lot happening. And I mean, like I said, on the rewatch, I think I was able to, you know, catch up on a lot of the dialogue, because it's structured in a way that is a little bit out of time. Definitely bounces around in its narrative structure in the same way that Citizen Kane does. And I mean, obviously a tremendous number of other films, but it's a high quality homage to that film as well as Hollywood in that era. And I mean, like you said about Bruce, about how the movie's about how Citizen Kane got made. I think it's to an equal degree almost about just how movies were made at that time. You can definitely broaden it out.
How they were commenting on the politics of the time too. And we didn't realize it, I suppose, at the time.
Yeah. I mean, going into this, I did not expect for Upton Sinclair to play as large of a role as he does in the plot of the film. And also when we're talking about Oscars, I would love to see Arliss Howard, who played Louis B. Mayer, nominated as supporting actor, because his Mayer was incredible. He's not in a ton of scenes, but the scenes he is in, he just steals out from under everybody else. He is incredible.
When they had the writer's room, it drove me crazy that I couldn't keep everybody straight. Who is this one? I wanted to be able to slow it down a bit. So maybe a second viewing is the best thing for that.
Definitely give it another viewing. I think it will definitely reveal itself a little bit more in the same way that Citizen Kane is a film that you can rewatch so many times before you get, you know, the way that a camera move involves, you know, tables having to be cut in half so that a camera could flow through a window and then in one fell swoop go all the way, you know, through and have the table, you know, miraculously be there when a camera should have gone through it. Anyway, there's so many layers to it. And like you said, Bruce, the technical achievement of it is really profound in a way that I think only David Fincher is obsessive enough to really stick the landing on.
I still haven't gotten around to seeing this one either. And part of that one for me is this is one of those ones every year, both with like movies and albums, there's like a couple that I don't end up watching or listening to right when they come out because there's just too much around them. There's too much of like a discourse, to use a just beaten to death term. There's just too much discourse around it for me to like be able to appreciate the movie or the album on its own terms. So that one I'm waiting on, and I'll definitely see before the end of the year. But yeah, that's why I haven't gotten around to that one yet, is for that very particular reason, because obviously there was so much about this movie for so many months before it actually came out.
Yeah. And I mean, I know once it came out, there was kind of a negative feedback from critics. I don't know what it was necessarily that, you know, contributed to it. But I mean, to me, it's part of a much larger conversation with, you know, the back end of Hollywood, with script writing, with, you know, Citizen Kane itself, with the idea of criticism, because it's based on a really contentious Pauline Kael series of articles that she wrote for The New Yorker, which, you know, have been disputed, I think, to a degree as to, you know, where the sourcing was. Anyway, it's just part of a much larger conversation about the history of film, and yeah, just nails all of that. And I would totally encourage Bruce, go see it again. Jared, watch it a few times. Yeah.
It would be a great film to show after you show Citizen Kane in a film class, because it explains a lot of things. It helps you understand a lot of things. And then you get to know the characters behind the names. Oddly enough, I don't think that Orson Welles is in it enough for you to even call it anything to do with Citizen Kane, but you know what I mean? And the guy who plays him is really good. He really makes you think, yeah, that's Orson Welles.
Yeah, Orson Welles at the absolute peak of his power.
Right, right.
You know, because, I mean, once Citizen Kane came out, he was not blacklisted, but the fallout with Hearst papers, you know, slamming the film, you know, really, really did a number on Orson Welles' career.
He never really got to make a movie on his own terms ever again after that.
Well, he should have won Best Picture for that, but they were all too scared to give it to him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there you go. But fascinating film, and it's black and white, which of course I love, and I have friends who go, oh my God, if it's not in color, I'm not watching it.
Yeah, so, and really, really soft black and white too. It's not like the contrast is not cranked up. It's not super sharp. All the grays are very, you know, shifty. Again, the technical elements of it were really, really well done. So I think that leaves Bruce with your last one.
My last one, maybe this is one that Jared will like. Sound of Metal. Did you see Sound of Metal?
I have not, but I've heard good things about this one as well.
It's about a drummer who starts losing his hearing, and he doesn't know do. You know, he wants to keep playing music. He still wants to do all that. But everybody tells him, you're going to lose your hearing. You've got to make a decision about your life and what you're going to do. And it's this kind of wrestle that he has with, this is who my identity is. I can't change. What am I going to do with my life? Is my life even worth living? And Riz Ahmed plays the drummer in, he's remarkable, remarkable. What they do with it that's so different is that you will hear what he hears. So when you're when somebody is talking to him, it will be subtitled and you'll be able to read what he's supposed to be hearing. But when you, if you just listen to the sound, it's like, what was that? What did he say? And you get a sense of what he's going through. Remarkable. And it really shows how you can overcome any kind of problem, I guess, and really find a different path for yourself. Like I say, Riz is so good at playing all these things that you feel every emotion that he feels as he's going through it.
Yeah. And that's one that I think kind of fell through the cracks a little bit for me. I mean, it's like Jared said, it's on my list, but there's something about the distribution method of it. It's on Amazon Prime. I don't know at what point they picked it up to distribute it, but they released that on Amazon Prime right around the same time that they were rolling out all of the Steve McQueen, you know, movies, the Small X series. And so I think Steve, like all the Steve McQueen stuff kind of stole the thunder as far as critical, you know, where do you put it in a critical spectrum? Sound of Metal, that is. And yeah, and that's, I mean, it's also one, I mean, to hear you talk about the sound design of it, I'm really excited to actually listen to it on headphones. And that's another one, I guess, that like being in a theater with a, you know, a real tuned up, you know, sound system where it can, you know, bounce it off the walls and everything. I'm sure that they did the post-production work to make that function in a theater and, you know, just to have it in, you know, in your den, if you don't have a big sound system, it's not going to have the same effect.
I think, well, yeah, largely because there's a through line here of sign language and sign language being used. This is making me think, even though tonally they're very different movies, but it's the only other movie I can think of where sign language is prominently used. It was one from a couple years ago that went even more all in on that. And that's, there's a movie from 2014. I don't know if either one of you saw it, called The Tribe. Have either one of you seen that one?
It's been on my list. I know about it, but I haven't actually seen it.
It's a Ukrainian movie that's has a little bit of like Catcher in the Rye vibes almost, about this kid. He's a teenage boy, and I think it's supposed to be in Kiev in Ukraine. He gets to a boarding school that's a boarding school for people who are deaf. And it sort of, yeah, plays out a little bit like Catcher in the Rye, with also a little bit of like a crime drama element to it. And the entire movie is in Ukrainian sign language and there's no subtitles. And so kind of like you were saying, maybe a little bit with some of the sound design in Sound of Metal, Bruce, you really are kind of forced to occupy the world that the people in the movie occupy. And like with Sound of Metal, most of the cast members are people who are deaf and have to use sign language. And so it made me think of that movie, which is another fantastic one to watch, although obviously a lot different than a movie about a drummer.
Look at this year, how sound will be a category that really has some different elements to it, because Mank, it would be a sound nominee. This would be, usually it's these kind of big super blockbustery kind of things where it's just loud. And
but there's none of those really.
We don't have those because the Marvel Universe was shut down for a year.
Yeah, everything got pushed back. I mean, thank God. Well, not thank God, but you know, that they were able to wrap up everything for their whole that you know, final wave of films last year. Because I mean, if you had to deal with actually putting those out this year, it's would have been a nightmare for them, and also. I mean, when we talked about the blurring of TV and films, I mean, I think Disney is going to end up playing a really interesting role in furthering the blurring of that. With, I mean, you look at, I mean, the Mandalorian is the absolute best Star Wars content that we've had in decades, and that's a TV show. And the next, you know, big series of Marvel things are going to be the WandaVision and what, you know, the various other things that are coming out on Disney Plus.
Disney is going to their streaming service for Soul, which is their big Pixar film for the year. And again, if they're taking that risk with content that, you know, look how many years you only could see them in theaters. That was it. And then they were even kind of skeptical about putting them out on VHS and then DVD. And now they're just going straight to your house. So it's interesting how that's all playing out.
Yeah. I also, Soul is one of those movies. I know, Bruce, I think you've actually seen it through screeners and, you know, for review. But that's one that doesn't come out until next week being Christmas week, on Disney Plus. And I am, you know, certainly wondering if you think, you know, from the year that we've been friends and interacted so regularly about film, if you think that Soul would have ended up ranking on my list if I'd seen it before our conversation today.
I don't know. To be honest with you, I don't know. Maybe it is the best place for it to be is on a streaming service, because I think if parents took their kid to see this, they'd go, well, the kid is running all around the theater. They're not even paying attention. It's very Inside Out. It's very kind of getting into the minds of people. And what do they do? You know, if you had a second chance at redoing what you've done in life, would you redo it, or would you, you know? So there's a lot of heavy thinking. It is a very 2020 kind of film too, in its sensibilities, but I don't know if you would put it on your list. I'll be honest with you. If it had a little more horror in it, Jared would put it on his list.
I mean, yeah. Yeah. And we've got, speaking again about kind of the blurring of things, one of the ones that I had shortlisted, and I just watched it recently because it just came out, was Let Them All Talk, the new Steven Soderbergh that's on HBO Max. And that seems like another example of a movie. I mean, Steven Soderbergh is so good at making those just kind of hangout movies, like all of the, Oceans movies that he's done, and Logan Lucky are, you know, you just want to hang out with these folks, and Let Them All Talk is kind of the same thing. And I could see a lot of directors from his generation just going to these streaming services and, you know, making these kind of casual films. I think Let Them All Talk was shot in less than 2 weeks, I want to say. Most of it was shot on the Queen Mary, the cruise ship, which obviously now that is, that's, you know, not really a thing. So yeah.
Do you remember the time when he said he wasn't going to make films anymore?
Yeah.
And then he really has been making films, but he's making films on his own terms and his own way. Is he behind Merrily We Roll Along? It's like Boyhood, where they go, they're going to do it every, you know, 10 years or so. Or somebody else with that? Do you know?
I think that is another, it's the same guy who did Boyhood, I believe, is doing that.
Yeah, Linklater.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's that kind of stuff where they're, you know, we don't have a deadline. We're not going to be getting this done in time for Christmas next year. We'll get it done when we get it done. And if it's tomorrow, we'll put it out tomorrow. That's kind of the new philosophy I think they've got.
For sure.
So then, okay, we have to ask a good wrap-up question here for the end of the year. What are you going to look at first over the holiday break? What's on that list, the top of the list?
Chris, you want to take that first?
Well, I mean, once we're done with this conversation, I think I'm going to watch the final episode of The Mandalorian. And then, yeah, Christmas Day is going to be, you know, Soul and Wonder Woman, I guess. And then that's, I don't know. I'm going to try to read. I think it's more just try to unplug as much as possible, for the next little bit. And, Jared.
Well, I'm with Chris on the whole reading thing. Cause I've been on I've talked about it before, but I'm still on a Cormac McCarthy kick, and I just got done reading another one of his books. But movie wise, older stuff, I think I'm going to keep watching through. Since the pandemic started, I've slowly been watching through every single Scorsese movie and short and documentary. And I'm still right now only up to like Raging Bull. So I've got a ways to go. For newer stuff, I think it's going to be a lot of the stuff we talked about today that I just haven't gotten to yet. Because they're all on my letterboxed on the watch list, and I just haven't gotten to them yet. And I'm going to have some time off, and so I'm definitely going to use that time to catch up on some of these before the year's up.
Bruce?
I will have seen everything by that time, so I might be watching something old. You know, I keep looking at it every time when I scroll through, and I don't know if it's Netflix or some Amazon, maybe. One of them has Fargo, and I want to go back and see Fargo again. And I thought that might be a really good kind of post-holiday, I'm going to sit and just watch this and see if I can see the way some of these things panned out after that and where the connections might be. I did see Midnight Sky, which is the new George Clooney film. And I'll be honest with you. Does everybody in Ocean's 11 need to do some kind of space film where they're all left alone? I thought of Martian. I thought of, you know, all these things. And I thought, yeah, I don't think I need it. And I mean, it was okay. But I wasn't like, oh, my God, he's back. He's doing what he needs to do. It's just, it is what it is.
Yeah.
So I'm going back to Wallow and Virgo.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Are we good?
I think so.
I think we're good. Yeah. Everybody's got homework to watch something good at home. And, I mean, there's no shortage of that, of stuff that's coming out soon. So, yeah, see something good.
See something good at home.
At home. So, that is the end of the episode. You can check the show notes for links to where you can stream the movies that we talked about, discover older episodes, and find ways to contact Bruce, Jared, and myself as well, if you want. The show is produced by myself, Jared, and Bruce, and I'm the one who records and edits it. As always, thank you all so much for listening. Tell your friends about it if you like it. We hope you enjoyed it and are taking care of yourselves out there. And Happy New Year. Bye!